Hello, and welcome to Towards the Point, a cultural compass for Pompey and beyond. I'm James Sandy, and with my co-presenter Simon Mobbs, we'll be exploring weird and wonderful exhibits from our popular culture. In the next half hour, we can promise you art in the shape of a recent exhibition by Edward Burrough. We'll also be looking at film, the nature of film funding, and the enduring format of the biopic. We'll also be having an interesting discussion, hopefully, about the way we read. We'll also make sure we give you a good roundup of choice local acts and events. So what, you might ask, is the point that we're moving towards? Well, Simon, I think what we're trying to do is have a stab at arts and culture, really, isn't it?
Yeah, definitely. If it's literature, music, comedy, any of that kind of stuff, and it's happening locally, we're going to be interested in it.
A bit of anything. So it could be an avant-garde dance movement, it could be Morris dancing, it could be anything.
We're all good with Morris dancing.
And what we should say is we're very open to suggestion. And if you'd like something featured on the programme, or indeed you've got an item for the programme, then let us know. There'll be details coming up right at the end for you to feedback. We're going to kickstart the show with art, which is Simon's bag. He's a real expert. Edward Burrough, tell us something about... You've been to an exhibition, I think, in Chichester recently.
That's right, yes. I've been to the retrospective of Edward Burrough's work at the Pallant House Gallery in Chichester. And I did enjoy the exhibition very much. It's probably one of the most enjoyable exhibitions I've seen at Pallant House. I felt that the work of his was very challenging and direct, but also there was a lot of humour in there. It was quite sensitively observed at times, very atmospheric.
So tell us a bit about Edward Burrough, because it's not a name I know much about.
Okay, so Edward Burrough was born in the early part of last century and lived through to the mid-70s. He could be described as a disabled painter, but that would be a description he was not pleased with himself. He had considerable illness throughout most of his life. He had arthritis, rheumatism, to name just a few illnesses. He was so ill as a child, for example, that he didn't actually go to school. He had no formal education until he got to college age, in which he went to, for example, the Royal College of Art and studied painting. He didn't have a huge amount of energy, and he had to stay quite kind of based living near his parents or with his parents. So what he would do is he would have quite regular trips to places such as America and Europe, where he would find inspiration for his paintings.
So what kind of thing inspired him? What kind of thing sort of drew him to paint? And he mainly is a painter, that's his form.
Yeah, definitely. He was really interested in urban life. That was the thing that he became most famous for. If you've only seen a few Edward Burrough paintings, the likelihood is they are of urban scenes.
So we're breaking new ground here because Simon now is going to describe one of these paintings on radio, which is, you know, obviously a great use of radio. But Simon, tell us a little bit more about the image. Quite a striking image.
Yeah, definitely. The painting we're looking at is called Dockside Café Marseille, and it was made in 1929. When we initially look at the image, it does look like what the title suggests. In the background, we appear to have a window which looks onto a dockside scene with a boat and some cranes. And in the main part, in the foreground of the image, we've got a scene of a bar with some waitresses and bar ladies serving to what appear to be two dockside workers, flat caps, one smoking a fag, the other's ordering a drink. However, if you start to look at this scene on closer inspection, what you can see is, for example, that the woman behind the bar probably isn't a woman. She's actually got a fake chest, and it actually looks remarkably like a man in drag. Probably is a man in drag and actually has the hand held quite camply. If you look at the dockside workers, one of them's got ballet shoes on and actually also a pink top as well. So initially what starts out to look like a dockside cafe actually turns out to probably be a gay bar with somebody who is a ballet dancer as one of the main characters in here.
So there are themes, I think, of a kind of underlying sexual political element.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, back at that time that this was created, it would have been considered almost like low art to be looking at this kind of aspect of society, to be kind of going to these kind of cafes, bars, clubs, all these kind of places that he sourced inspiration from. And in a lot of ways, it would have been considered that he was making low culture into high art.
I'm really interested in the style because, you know, to an uneducated person like me in the realms of art, there's a cartoon-like element, I think, to the picture. It's very striking. It's very simple images. And it's something I think that it's interesting because people will look at it and they would instantly recognise elements of it. But as you're saying, there's a lot kind of hidden behind it.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. I mean, I think it's a good point you make. It is quite designed, and his work is often very kind of composed and very crammed, lots of stuff going on, not a huge amount of negative space. His work is very designed, and it's been described like that many times before. His sense of composition, the kind of angles he uses, the sort of slight amount of abstraction here. Also, in terms of the kind of caricature idea, he definitely has been influenced by people like Otto Dix or Hogarth, caricatures of working class life, the fringes of society, that kind of thing.
He himself, is he an influence to other artists today? Are there other kind of people who would perhaps build their work on, or...?
I'm not aware of a huge amount that has been, but he's certainly one of those people that's been in the background for quite a long time. I mean, I've certainly seen a lot of his works, for example, his Harlem paintings. I've seen those around numerous times. But after going to the exhibition, I've really got more of a sense of the wider picture of his work and what his career was like, you know, from the young man right through to old age.
Tell me a bit about the exhibition itself in terms of the kind of what of the collections on display.
Okay.
Tell me about the layout of that kind of...
Okay, so it takes you through it what room by room, theme by theme, but also through the years, really. So we've got a whole room dedicated to his studies of urban life. So these paintings that I'm now showing you here, for example, Harlem 1934... and Harlem Scene 1934 to 1935. These are the kind of things which would be archetypally Burr, as far as I'm concerned. These are the kind of things that a lot of people would have seen before. He was a great fan of American culture, of jazz music, and he was actually described as the best painter of the American scene. When I first saw these paintings, you know, quite a few years ago, I'd have probably presumed he was an American painter. It's quite interesting that he's actually, you know, this English character who has visited America frequently and depicted it from the outskirts, really, as an onlooker, as opposed to somebody actually involved within the culture.
So what about style and technique? You're an artist by trade. What kind of things can we learn from Burr in terms of how he approaches art?
Okay, so he's a watercolour artist, but not really a watercolour artist. When you look at the work initially, it looks almost man-made. It's very smooth, and you can not really see any brush strokes in there. It also has a kind of vivid sense of colour, which isn't always associated with watercolour. If we look at this piece, for example, here, the Silver Dollar Bar, 1953, you get this really nice luminous sense of colour rising over the bar workers in the picture. There's kind of like an underlit set of lights underneath the bar, shining up on the bar workers and the patrons in the bar. There's also artificial lighting in the background, like a yellow tungsteny kind of light. And he really gets this all across very well, with a great kind of lightness of touch. You know, it's rich, vibrant, smooth, man-made looking. In terms of his kind of pictorial style, we were saying before, it's often very designed, very compact in terms of composition, definitely making reference to caricaturists such as Otto Dix and Hogarth. In the way that he made this, it was also quite unique. It was possibly because he was quite an ill man himself, that he would work on a tabletop, which is quite unusual, totally flat surface, would draw from memory, so he wouldn't actually make any reference images whilst he was visiting, for example, New York. He would wait till weeks, months later when he's back in England on the dining room table, and there he would pencil out these remembered images. And then literally from one corner of the paper upwards, he would add the colour.
That is very unusual because a number of artists would have a sketchbook or, you know, kind of notebooks that they would, you know, even if they didn't draw an outline of something, they would make notes about colour or texture.
Yeah, it's quite extraordinary, really. I mean, when you look at the amount of paintings that are at the exhibition, there's about 100 there. And not one of them he kind of created that kind of preliminary sketches for. It's all from memory. You do think this must be somebody with a very, very good memory and a great eye for detail as well.
Tell us something about some of the other key paintings that are at the exhibition, because whenever you go to an art exhibition, there are always ones that you have to see, I think, aren't there? Kind of, if it's Van Clonk or Giles, you know, whoever it is, there are key things you've got to go and see.
Okay, so in contrast to maybe these more feel-good, lively kind of examples of the New York scene, we've got this image here called The Straw Man from 1963, which is actually set in the UK, and it's of a kind of derelict industrial scene, and in particular four young unemployed men kicking ritualistically a straw man. The painting makes reference to the Matisse painting, The Dance, in terms of the way that they're composed, and they almost look like they're dancing around this straw man figure. But after that, that's really where the lightness stops. It's got a very kind of brooding, menacing kind of sense to it. You know, why are they beating the hell out of this straw man? Presumably they haven't got much else to do. They're unemployed, they've got a lot of time on their hands. They've got various serious intent faces. Is there kind of repressed anger here? And if so, is it really well directed at this straw man? Should they be angry at other things? There's also kind of things going on in the background. You've got a train rattling by, which kind of creates a sense of sound. And you've also got a mother walking a young child past the scene as if to say, you know, don't pay any attention to these men. You know, they're not really, you know, doing anything sensible with their time. And the sense of colour is also quite disconcerting. What gets me is it's got no head, this particular straw man, but you've got this kind of vivid red kind of hole, I presume,
where kind of neck stump.
Yeah. And although we know it's a straw man, it brings a kind of slightly brutal edge to it. And it's the only vivid red part of that image, otherwise, which is quite a grey and mid-tone kind of scene.
So there's a kind of conscious contrast to, as you mentioned, the kind of Matisse painting, which is, I suppose, is about, you know, a very positive image about kind of, I suppose, in some ways, about sort of friendship in the, you know, kind of, or the kind of medium of dance. Yeah. And this image is, as you described, quite brutal and quite ritualistic, and you know, it's a very clever reference point, I think.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think whereas you see the dance is a very celebratory piece, this looks to be like the thing that's bringing them together is their anger, is their frustration, is their boredom, and you know, in particular, one of the characters looks very blue, which suggests a kind of solemn kind of atmosphere.
So it's kind of melancholic, isn't it, I think?
Yeah, definitely.
Excellent. So folks that want to go along to the exhibition and want to kind of see these pieces, and I would recommend it because I'm very impressed with kind of what you've described to us. Where do they go, and how long is it on for?
Okay, so it's on until the 16th of February at Pallant House Gallery in Chichester. Definitely recommend it.
So from art to film. Now, if you've picked up in the news recently that there are big changes in terms of the UK film industry, you're right. There's been a recent UK film policy review, chaired, I think, by former Culture Secretary Lord Smith, Chris Smith. Basically, there's a number of changes going on in terms of how films are funded. And one of the significant changes is the abolition of the UK Film Council. Parts of its role have now, I think, been moved to the BFI, which is the British Film Institute. Really, I thought it's a really interesting set of questions about how we see film and how film is being funded these days. There's an assertion, I think, in the policy review, really they're funding commercially successful films. Really, I think, could squeeze out a number of what you might call art house, kind of local or independent films. Also, there's some stuff in the review which is worth mentioning because it recognises very much that this is a changing industry, a changing format, if you like. So it talks about television and television production companies investing much more in film, but it's also trying to recognise that, you know, the way we watch TV, the way we consume these things, if I can use that analogy, is changing with more and more on demand and different platforms. So people are watching, for example, films on tablets or smartphones when they're going back and forth to, you know, wherever they work. You know, and people are watching films on demand at different times and different rates and being much more selective, I think, in terms of what they're watching. Now, there's a research and development fund that's being created through the policy review. And there's also something called the virtual print fee, which I don't fully understand, but it's something to do with the distribution of films. And I think that's really to try and give a break to some of the independent cinemas who, I think, frankly, are struggling with the onset of, you know, actually getting the films to show. But also, more and more people have Sky and other providers who are quite happy to sit at home and experience cinema in their front room. And I think there's been a lot of change there as well in terms of, you know, everyone, well, not everybody, but a lot of people have 50-inch televisions and massive surround sound. So they've got their own cinema in their front room. But I was just interested, Simon, in terms of, for me, there are a number of questions around this in terms of the kind of commercial versus creative. And I think it's been said that, you know, what perhaps government's trying to do is create a commercially successful business. And it is a commercially successful business. But if it's completely driven by the market and by commerce, then you're essentially trying to create Hollywood. I think, and Hollywood itself based itself on Elstree, you could argue, a long, long time ago. So, what from your point of view, in terms of film as a medium, if you like, as an art form, what kind of effect do you think this kind of change might have in terms of the quality of film, if you like?
It does sound tricky to me because I've heard a few objections to this, and I think quite a valid one is that, of course, you might want to make films which are going to be commercially successful, but if that is the be and the end all of it, if that's the key thing that you're aiming for, it can limit the creativity of the films that are going to be made. I mean, if you look at some of the British successes, such as Trainspotting, Gosford Park, you know, these may not have been considered, you know, surefire bets when they were first created, but, you know, went on to be very successful and spawn off, you know, careers after that.
Those ones that you mentioned, those films that you mentioned there, they weren't anticipated to be successful films. It was kind of, they were wild cards, really, and someone took risks on them. And I think potentially that's the danger, I think, of this change, that it takes out that element of risk, because it, you know, it's saying that there should be a guaranteed return on the investment. And actually, you know, if you look at films like Waterworld, for example, which is often touted as being, you know, the kind of one of the worst box office film, whether it's a good or a bad film is a, you know, a point of debate, really. But, you know, it was one of the biggest box office flops, but it had millions and millions of pounds thrown into it. So I think, you know, there is a question there for me about how we, you know, measure the success of a film. Really, I think film and creative industry has to be allowed to kind of to grow and take those risks, and you know, there is a flexibility that's demanded, I think, there.
Yeah, definitely. And I think what's also interesting is from a technology point of view, I guess I'd hope I was right in saying that it can be a lot cheaper to make films now. And, you know, if you've got a script, if you've got actors involved, I mean, for example, one of the best films I think that's been made in recent years is This Is England, which I'm imagining isn't a huge, huge budget, but the subject matter and the quality of the acting is what makes it. And, you know, maybe, you know, we want to be promoting those kind of films that aren't going to be a massive drain on budget. But if they do make it, could have substantial returns. But you don't go into a film like that thinking this is going to be a commercially successful film. I don't think that was the key objective.
Indeed. And that's a very interesting example, because I know that the success of that film has spawned TV series, which the production companies have inevitably used the profits from to reinvest in film. So... Yeah. I think, you know, there's a very difficult balance, I think, and it's, you know, we find ourselves always looking at kind of the cost of things rather than the value of things. I think that there's really something to that. The other element for me is that this is very much focused on UK film, and it's not just talking about actors, it's talking about directors, and it's talking about, you know, all these roles that you see come up at the end of a film, you've no idea what they are, like the key grip and the best boy and all that kind of stuff. I don't know what those are still. But there's an assumption that a film can be kept within a country, really. And if you think about some of the big British successes, they've not actually been British films. They've been made by American production companies, or, you know, but they've all hired British kind of talent and creative talent, certainly on screen and behind the screen. So there's something for me in terms of the reviews recognising, I think, you know, that it's a changing global industry, but it's not always recognising that talent and that pool of skill is not just, can't be maintained within the border, I suppose, is what I'm saying.
I guess you get a lot of UK-based actors moving over to America, you know, appearing in HBO dramas, appearing in...
Indeed, yeah.
You know, in American films. And that's considered a good thing, you know, that we're kind of getting over there and we can do American accents and why not? That's considered not particularly good. You know, we kind of see, why is this American actress coming over and doing a Northern accent, presumably quite badly? I haven't seen it, but we're quite defensive in a way. Do you know what I mean?
I do, yeah. And I think, to me, you know, the key test is, can they act? And if they can act, they can probably do accents. But you're right. I mean, there is... an increasing trend, certainly through production companies like HBO, to bag a British actor to lead, quite often doing an American accent. One of the greatest examples of that, I think, is the series Deadwood. I don't know if you've picked up on that, which has Ian McShane, who everyone knows and loves as Lovejoy, as a kind of strange kind of brothel-owning, innkeeping rogue. Basically, but I mean, he's great in that role. And the other success, of course, we should mention, is House. You know, Hugh Laurie has gone leaps and bounds into that, and in fact launched his own kind of jazz pianist career now, which is another interesting dimension. And so you could ask, you know, would all that creativity unfold from a very structured industry, which is, well, if this doesn't make money, you know, we're not going to fund it. You know, so it's some interesting interesting stuff there. The other element of film I want to discuss is the kind of enduring idea of the biopic, you know, the kind of the life story writ large with a famous actor or actress. And currently we have a very good example of that in The Iron Lady, which is Meryl Streep doing her Margaret Thatcher routine, which has just been released at the cinema. It's not a film I've seen yet, so I won't pass comment on it, but I know there's been a lot in the news about how good her performance is. But also there's been a backlash, really, I think, in terms of how her life has been handled in that film. And it's one of a growing number of films that look at the political legacies of individuals. I'm thinking also of Frost Nixon, which a couple of years was a major success with Michael Sheen in the David Frost role, a brilliant film. We've also got a curious example which has cropped up. I don't know if you've seen this, where Leonardo DiCaprio is playing J. Edgar Hoover, which I imagine could lead to a whole host of amusing scenes. But I mean, we've also had Kevin Costner not playing JFK, but exploring the life of JFK as well. So what's important to me about this, and the reason I wanted to kind of raise this on the show, is that you know, there's a great degree of poetic license and artistic license that's added to these people's sagas, if you like. And I think there's a danger in sort of, you know, the kind of the Vaseline lens view. And I think it'd be interesting going forward whether some of the more successful films, linking to what we said perhaps previously, some of the more successful coverage of these people's lives is a little bit more challenging, a little bit more testing. I don't know what your thoughts are on all of this.
I mean, the last biopic I saw was the Ian Dury, the Blockheads biopic. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that was fantastically acted and it had some great examples of art in there as well, with some of the animation sequences. Before that, the Coco Chanel and also a little known one about a painter called Seraphine, a French production. I guess the thing for me is that I do enjoy them, but they're not the first film I would choose to see, because for me, sometimes the formula repeats itself in that you kind of have quite often a creative or highly individual character who maybe isn't faithful to the partner, who doesn't believe in themselves, then kind of goes through some kind of transformation and does believe in themselves, gets the break.
For me, one of the things that they quite often do is they kind of glaze over large and significant elements of these people's lives and careers.
Yeah, I mean, one of the kind of things I've heard about the Thatcher film is that it's very much a kind of portrait of old age as well. It's what happens to somebody as they, you know, age over the years. Yeah. And people haven't always been happy about the portrayal of Thatcher, because it portrays her in some ways as quite weak towards the end.
A character like Margaret Thatcher is always going to be controversial, you know, and kind of, you know, you will get the love and hates in probably equal measure. A difficult one to take on. I think there's something to be said, I think, about the actor or the actress taking on the role. I mean, again, I haven't seen the film, but I've heard Meryl Streep is very good. If you take, for example, an actor like Anthony Hopkins, who in his time has played Richard Nixon and Pablo Picasso, which is, you know, two ends of an extreme, if you like. But also, if you think of Benicio del Toro in the Che films, which were two very long films in Spanish, but very, very, very good films, and very kind of, you know, gripping in the sense that, you know, you kind of thought, oh, you know, it's the age-old thing, I don't want to read this film. But actually, you know, 5 minutes in, you think, hold on, there's something to this. And and it is, I suppose, you know, that's the difficulty, isn't it, for filmmakers? It's kind of picking on controversial and interesting characters and relaying that as a story that's accessible and engages people without sort of, you know, laying on too much of the historical, ideological, political.
I mean, and I think it's you know, there's a key couple of things they're going to choose. It's going to be the coming of age part, you know, where they move from being an adolescent to an adult. There's going to be their love interest, and there's going to be any tensions they had there.
And of course, before we move on, we must remember that I think you mentioned to me recently that the comic strip, the comedy outfit from starting in the 80s, actually did start this in terms of having, I think, Meryl Streep suggested as the actress to play Thatcher.
Yeah, was it Jennifer Saunders playing Meryl Streep playing Margaret Thatcher 20 years ago, like a kind of preview of what's happening now? And back then it would probably seem like a parody, but it's now come true.
Yeah. And now we move to literature, or to be more precise, reading. Now, I've got a bit of a problem with reading. I can read, but I don't do a lot of reading. Or at least I don't do a lot of kind of reading for pleasure. Now, Simon, you are a big reader, I've discovered, or you're perhaps a born-again reader. Is that a fair description?
Yeah, definitely. Over the last sort of year, I've really got back into reading novels, and I'm working my way through them at quite a rate. Currently reading a Murakami novel called The Wind-Up Bird Chronicle, which is very surreal but brilliant.
We were discussing the other day kind of what we read, and I find that when I do read, which is very rarely, I enjoy the biography or the autobiography more than I do kind of fiction, which is strange because, you know, I like good stories. But I find factual stuff more, I don't know, more interesting, more, I suppose it's about knowledge for me, maybe. I mean, it's a very personal thing, I think, reading. I think said to you that probably, I have probably read more than this, but novels that I've read that I can remember reading is probably American Psycho and The Last King of Scotland, which probably says a lot about me, I think. I've read a lot more biographies than that. But I think in this day and age, we're all very limited in terms of free time that we have. You know, we've got busy lives and families and all those kind of things, which is very positive, you know. But we are also in an age of the e-book and the e-reader. And I think that changes the process of reading. And I think that people are filtering out different bits of information and treating reading perhaps in a different way. What do you think of that?
Yeah, it's interesting because I heard Frank Skinner saying on the radio recently that he reads a lot of poetry, and he's surprised that more people don't do so, because poetry is very bite-sized and you can, you know, get a fix of your reading in, you know, a matter of minutes and then put it down, whereas a novel is a much more of a commitment. And I do wonder if there's something in that. I mean, quite often when I consume my news, I don't watch the news from start to finish, 6 to 6:30 or something like that. I'll go onto the BBC News site and watch a couple of the news stories that interested me, and then within 10 minutes I've got the news that I want. It's like a bespoke selection that I've been able to make for myself. So, you know, sitting down and reading for, you know, a number of nights in a row maybe doesn't fit into the culture that we've got at the moment.
I think it's a change that's happened very quickly. I think certainly if you take newspapers as an example, I now only buy a newspaper on the weekend, whereas, you know, I used to buy one every day. Now, I still read papers, but I read them online, or I read them on my phone or whatever. And, you know, now I don't just read one paper. I can read four or five different papers. Or indeed, I can look directly at Reuters, where papers get, you know, a news agency where they get the stories from, and read that directly. And that's, you know, we're fortunate, I think, in this age that, you know, we have more and more information. And we're also in a position where, you know, if we are writers and we write books, you know, we can publish very easily, and, you know, we can actually make money from our outpourings, as it were. But it seems that there are negatives to that. It seems that actually that perhaps focusing on books or reading particular books, you know, people have less and less time for. I don't, you know, kind of.
Yeah, definitely, definitely. And I mean, you know, if you're consuming the news, you know, you've got rise of papers like the iPaper, where, you know, it's a very condensed version of the newspaper. There seems to be a demand for being able to get reading material in a condensed form, and books, novels don't necessarily easily fit into that format. Although I would say that I'm a big fan of audiobooks and listening to them on my iPod. And I know Stephen Fry is a great kind of advocate of the greatness of these. And, you know, the idea is that he can plug one of these in, go walking around London, and you can just, you know, wander for like a couple of hours and let somebody else do all the reading for you, and just, you know, you just take it in. And I do think audiobooks have got a lot of potential. It's interesting, I was in Japan a few years ago, and their culture of manga comics is interesting, because if you go into a bookstore or newsagent, maybe like at least a third of the material is illustrated. And the culture is that it's very cheaply produced on newsprint, hundreds of pages, and you might buy something, read it on the commute, and then throw it away when you're done with it. You know, you don't keep it. And it's that cheap, it's that throwaway, it's visual, so at the end of the day, you don't have to concentrate too much. And that kind of commuter-friendly reading material, you know, it's an interesting sort of other option.
If you fancy a little bit of Dickens, you can go and see David Copperfield at the King's Theatre. That's between the 7th and the 11th of February. Also, Paul Daniels, the magician, the great magician, will be appearing at the King's Theatre.
Fantastic.
On the 22nd of February. I'm very excited. I might even buy a ticket myself to that. At the Nuffield in Southampton, Suggs, he of madness fame, will be doing My Life Story. So he's doing a kind of spoken word evening, talking about his life and his trials and tribulations on Sunday, February 12th. We'll look forward to that. Simon, thank you very much.
Thank you.
We'll be back again next month for more art, culture, and, well, discussions about maybe some of the finer things in life. I've been James Sandy, he's been Simon Mobbs. and we'll see you again next month. For more information on some of the items in this programme, check out our blog at kingofthebuttons.typepad.com/TTP. Towards the Point is a King of the Buttons production for 93.7 Express FM.